I'm Scott Hansen, host of NFL Red Zone. Lowe's knows Sundays hit different when you earn them. We've got you covered with outdoor power equipment from Kobalt and everything you need to weatherproof your deck with Trex decking. Plus, with lawn care from Scotts and, of course, Pit Boss grills and accessories, you can get a home field advantage all season long. So get to Lowe's, get it done, and earn your Sunday. Lowe's, official partner of the NFL.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Hey, look, I'm sorry. I know you told me not to do this anymore, that I'm supposed to let you go through the dream where you think you're a monkey descendant. But I miss you, and I know I always do this. I guess I know it's rude. I'm sorry. It's selfish. What am I even doing? I should let you sleep. Okay, I'm sorry. I swear, I'm not. I'm going to go right back in to being the person that you're dreaming that I am. A podcaster. Why did you make me a podcaster in your dream? You could have made me a Hyperion chest, but you made me a podcaster. So I know I have a rotten voice, but I'm just gonna sing the song that you used to sing to me when I was sleeping, and then I swear I'm just gonna go right back to being Duncan Trussell. Man, what a weird name. What a weird dream. You are a very, very strange dreamer, and I'm really sorry. I'm sorry. I always do this. I miss you.
We are all just riverbeds for love older than time, and all that this love touches, it refines. Those dark clouds inside of you that you've been hiding from, they're the things that make this river run. You're a squid inside an orb suspended above a fountain.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's me, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. I'm really sorry if you're getting like some kind of like background hum. I've got a UFO that has been hovering over my backyard for the last, I don't know, 2 days, and it's beautiful. It looks exactly like UFOs look in pictures, silver disc. It's truly the most beautiful thing that I have ever seen in my life, and I can't believe that I've been given the great honor of witnessing it. I love the UFO, and I'm really excited that it's hovering around me, but it is a little frustrating because I would like to be able to talk about all the aspects of the UFO and some of the things that I've seen inside the UFO and some of the things that the UFO is helping me construct and some of the beings within the UFO. But I signed an NDA. Don't do that. The truth of the matter is that the UFO captains know what they're doing, and I trust them. I trust their strategies, and I know that they know the best way to colonize this planet, and I'm going to help them if I can. But until then, let's do a commercial. Sweet friends, if you've listened to this podcast for any amount of time, you know, I sometimes try to do like, you know, creative commercials, but I've run into a weird paradox, which is that one of my favorite companies, Charlotte's Web, sponsored the podcast, and I have to be very careful about how I talk about it. So I'm just going to read right off the sheet. But you know that I do not promote anything on this podcast that I haven't enjoyed before or used, and I'm a big fan of Charlotte's Web. So I'm just going to read this right off the copy. Have you heard about hemp for health? Cannabinoids are naturally occurring antioxidants and neuroprotectants found in hemp plants. These hemp plants and their products, by the way, are totally legal in all 50 states. So these cannabinoids from hemp, and CBD in particular, are pretty popular in health circles for their ability to help maintain wellness inside and out. And now, you can get the benefits of hemp wherever your body needs it. The makers of Charlotte's Web whole plant hemp extract oils and capsules now make topical creams and balms. This isn't just a little bit of their premium whole plant hemp extracts added to a soothing botanical blend. This is 300 milligrams of hemp extract per ounce. That's three times more than other topical brands. Charlotte's Web Topical Creams also features oleosome technology to increase absorption of hemp and key botanical ingredients. My darlings, if you are interested in hemp extracts and have heard something about it that maybe appeals to you, I highly recommend Charlotte's Web. Do I find it odd that I live in a dimension where I have to be careful when I talk about hemp extract oil? Yes. I'm not going to rage against the machine here, though. It would be very easy for me to point out the Kafka-level absurdity in the fact that I cannot talk about certain things related to hemp extract oil that I would like to talk about. Because of the time period they were in, but I'm honestly grateful that Charlotte's hemp extract oil is available these days. Because when I was growing up, it wasn't. Charlotte's Web is offering a unique offer to our listeners. Go to cwhemp.com and enter code Duncan at checkout to get 10% off your order. Don't forget to enter code Duncan at checkout to get 10% off. Some exclusions apply. See website for details. Research. These statements have not been evaluated by the Food and Drug Administration. This product is not intended to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any disease. A massive thank you to the Lord of Procrastination, Carlton Blanche, for sponsoring not only this podcast, but also everything that I've ever done. I really appreciate all of your help in keeping me from finishing things. Boy, does it feel good to procrastinate. Also, a big thank you to my sweet Patreon patrons. I worship you and I love you. And of course, I am your eternal servant. And I hope you continue to show me the right way to be. Your many spankings and wonderful corrections have taught me how to truly be an obedient servant to your iron will. If you'd like extra episodes of the DTFH, if you're interested in hearing me ramble for an hour or more in a disorganized way, or if you just feel like listening to half-baked songs that I'm excited about only because I just recently learned how to use Ableton, or if you just want to hang out on the Discord server, which is connected to the DTFH, why not head over to patreon.com/DTFH. Also, we have got a whole bunch of new stuff in the shop. In fact, all new stuff. Check it out by going to DuncanTrussell.com. And we've got some new stuff coming, including, I'm pretty sure, ghost cubes, which will allow you to haunt your house. This is one of the main complaints these days because of the problem of new construction and the extension of the human lifespan, as well as, what appears to be a general diminishment in the violent crimes that created so many wonderful ghosts that so many families are enjoying in their very haunted homes. A lot of us don't get to have a poltergeist, wraith, or any kind of specter in our house. You got an unhaunted house. It's very similar to having an unheated hot tub. It's like, really? Nothing there. It just feels good and cheery and warm and light and bright. There's not a heavy, resounding sense of something horrific. There's no smells of boiling blood and no sounds in the middle of the night. No footsteps walking across your floor. No sleep paralysis. And of course, you never get that wonderful sound of a laughing child when you get up at night to stand in front of the mirror and moan. Go over to DuncanTrussell.com and just click on the store link and you'll see a lot of stuff. We don't have the cubes in there yet. Also, I'm not positive they're going to be cubes. They could be tetrahedrons, decadohedrons, quadrahedrons, or any of the various wonderful and amazing hedrons that are showing up these days. They could also be triangles or pretty much any shape, including ambiguous shapes or shape-shifting things such as balloons filled with mayonnaise. We'll find out. I don't know. I'm still waiting for the shipment to come in. It's not quite as easy as you might expect to harvest ghosts, especially in countries where the regulations are a little different. You end up, you know, trying to get a batch of poltergeists and you end up with demons or banshees, which of course we're not allowed to sell in America yet. But hopefully as the wonderful deregulation that happens continues, I will be able to sell all varieties of spiritual entities. But until then, we're going to just do your basic moaning ghosts and some poltergeists. And we'll see. We'll see. Friends, we have got a wonderful podcast for you today. These days, one form of art that I really appreciate is the kind that simultaneously transmits deep, inspirational, dharmic ideas without seeming sanctimonious, naive, idealistic, or just generally sappy. As someone who is deeply guilty of transmitting some spiritual message that is wrapped up in all kinds of melodrama and extra sap, I really love it when I find an artist who is conveying really big ideas in a simple way that is also beautiful, edgy, cool, and just grabs your heart and pulls it out of the ice cave that it might be imprisoned in temporarily because you are afraid to melt the ice cave, as Abraham Lincoln used to say. Today's guest is one of those kinds of artists. Not only is he a hilarious comedian, he's also a prolific progenitor of beautiful, beautiful comics and books and pictures, and also a pretty amazing podcast, which I've had the good fortune to appear on. It's called The Rainbow Brain Skull Hour, and it is at his website, which is located at RaminNazer.com. That's RaminNazer.com. I'm going to have links to that at DuncanTrussell.com. But I would invite you to take a deep dive into the wonderful ocean of art and comedy that this sweet human being is exploding into our dimension. Now, without further ado, please stretch your wings out, jump off of that rugged cliff face that you've been clinging to, and fly straight into the glowing, beautiful, hyper-colored, undulating, hypnotic spiral of sweet, compassionate, glorious love that makes up every single atom in today's guest's body, a massive welcome to Ramin Nazer.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
Welcome to the DTFH.
This episode is brought to you by Square Mattress.
Square Mattress.
Square Mattress is the only sure design you can get on your...
The only actual mattress that is a square. It's a, you know, the full fucking rectangular mattress fad has got to end. It's we weren't meant to sleep on a rectangle. We're meant to sleep on a fucking square. Do you fucking hear me?
Yeah, and don't get a mattress designer that's going to take all your money. You want a square mattress, just regular.
Do you fucking hear me? Like an angry mattress salespeople. Oh, you fucking just go to sleep.
You know how every company has a Twitter like personality now? Like everything is kind of funny. Every brand has a voice.
That's the new thing, right?
Yeah, that's not going to go anywhere, you think. It's like you're going to meet Wendy from Wendy's.
Well, we have to deal with it. It's like, you know, the thing is like, all right, well, they're not quite hypnotized anymore. They are aware of the fact that ultimately what's happening is it could be anything, but we're just trying to draw their attention to this particular thing, because the more attention we get on this particular thing, the more we can convert that attention into money, and the money is what pays for everything. So they know that kind of now. It's not serious anymore. Like,
yeah,
you know, so you know, the serious commercials, when you see them, it kind of feels like, wait, what the fuck? Like, what are you guys talking about? Like, the serious commercials don't...
Allstate cares. Yeah. Allstate gives a shit. Everyone else doesn't. That's a terrible impression of it, but whatever. I love terrible impressions.
That's a perfect impression. Or the new one is actually the apology commercial.
What's that one?
Like Uber and like some companies
will be like, oh, yeah. Listen. Moving forward, we actually care now.
Oh, yeah, we fucked up.
Remember when Domino's like just completely redid their whole pizza recipe? Like, we're starting from scratch. And it's so weird that there was no public outcry that like, no, bring back the original recipe. Not a peep. Everyone was like, yeah, okay, cool. Change your whole recipe.
Pizza. We don't care, man. We're going to keep eating it. It's like a phone number that I know. It's like a website I can easily get to. But yeah, so now it's like, and you see it also, you know, at the Emmys wrestle with it a little bit. Like you see anything that is attempting to give an aura of authority or importance these days seems a little ridiculous.
Yeah. Can you tell me about the Emmys? Because I don't know anything about what that... You mean it's like trying to get serious of like, and we care and we're going to save the climate change thing because we're actors. You mean that kind of thing?
So the Emmys are like... Well, I mean, you know, the business we're both in is... I guess one way you could put it is it's like a part of what we do is reality distortion, you know? So a comedian, a dramatic actor, a producer, director, writer, anybody generally who's like creating some form of entertainment is in some way, shape, or form emulating reality and then distorting it to some degree. Even news reporters do that too, you know, to make it entertaining. So the Emmys are a gathering of people who are experts at distorting reality. It's a room filled with some of the greatest reality distortion wizards.
Yeah, and they all wear black.
But to celebrate their craft of distorting reality for us, because we love to watch distorted realities. I do. I mean,
oh, yeah.
Fucking movies are the best thing ever. Love it.
Only getting better.
And yeah, only getting better. And so that's the Emmys. The Emmys is when all the great reality distortion wizards of the kingdom gather together to get to celebrate the best reality distorters.
Yeah.
And so, and because their craft is, you know, truly magical in the sense that, like, not only are they distorting reality, but from the reality distortion that they're doing, it produces ripples in matter. So, you know, one of the sad examples of it is whenever a talking chihuahua movie comes out, people adopt chihuahuas because the kids see it and they're like, mommy, I want a chihuahua.
Oh, or like with the owl in Harry Potter. There's so many abandoned owls. When Harry Potter movies came out, there was a big spike in owl purchases. And then when they turned 18 or whatever and had to go to college, like a lot of like, what am I going to do with this fucking owl?
That's it. Yeah, that's one of the byproducts of some great reality distortion is that it ends up getting things killed and or abandoned, you know, or you know, in a less sinister way of saying it is it just produces turns of phrase, you know. So all of a sudden people start saying groovy baby all over the fucking place, like what the fuck. It's like the great reality distortion wizards, they you know, create entertainment, and the entertainment is sticky and it reflects into the minds of the people, and then the people imitate it. So you get these, for a little bit, the great mass of humanity in whatever country your thing is the most popular in begins to reflect the thing you made and evolve that thing. Like kind of like what you're saying with like the new form of commercials, which is like, we're seeing these absurdist commercials that are, you know, all kind of like replicating this absurdist form, you know, and that trend is really interesting because when you think about it, it's like, okay, so I don't know. Can you think of something that's super popular right now in the culture? What's something that's like
Ariana Grande?
Okay. Ariana Grande.
Fidget spinners, or I'm probably late on that. That's probably 2015.
Let's go like, so like Ariana Grande. Let's
slime. Slime's huge with 12-year-olds.
Slime. There you go. Okay, slime. So slime, the creation of slime, making slime, selling slime, all of that stuff, like some really cool fucking nanny or babysitter or mom figured out a way to mix. I don't know how you make it. It's like cornstarch and something make slime.
No idea.
You can make it pretty easily.
Yeah.
It's like, it's something that seems like you don't want kids' hands in it, but it's actually safe, like borax or some shit. I can't remember. Don't do it, by the way, guys.
It doesn't sound safe.
I don't remember. Don't do that. I don't know how you make slime. But you, so like, say, you know, suddenly around some certain homes, people are making slime, right? And this is all happening because of the internet, and you get slime, like, recipes. And like, because you go to the store and you see slime for sale, and you're like, whoa, that shit's cool. And then you realize, like, wait, I can make this shit. And then you start making it at home, right? And so what inevitably starts happening is there are these scouts that are sent out into the smaller shared reality tunnels of people. And so the scouts in some way or another pick up, like, oh, okay, yeah, they're doing slime. Oh, they're doing slime. Slime, yeah. And then that becomes a trend. So the idea is, like, if I can predict cultural trends before they like really get big, then I can start producing slime and have it out there right when the wave peaks.
Yeah.
And so then now I'm going to sell the most slime, right? So anytime you see a thing that's popular, what you're looking at is actually the beginning of the thing's end.
Oh yeah, it is. It's so, especially with comedy, and it's you see so many jokes that were like just, I don't want to say being used a lot, whatever. Yeah. Just, like form. People saying like, oh, that's a thing, or said no one ever, like said no one ever was just, oh, that's so funny. And then you see, you know, an Allstate ad using it. And then of course it's over. And I always think of a commercial in 10 years, like you and I will probably think it's so funny if someone showed it to us now, a commercial from 10 years ago, that's taking comedy from 5 years from now. Did I say that right? Yeah. A commercial that's, or it'll probably be accelerating even more by then. It'll probably just Do you get that feeling of, especially in recent times, of like, oh man, I learned more in the last year than I did in the last 10 years. And then, oh man, I learned more in the last month than I learned in the last year. Oh man, I learned more in the last week than in the last month. And it's just like that constantly, like McKenna refers to it as the history as a basketball dropped and then it hits once, then the time before it hits again, until it's just going to be like flickering so fast that it'll just feel like now again. I think the changes are happening so quick that it'll eventually be so quick that it feels like not change again.
Yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about.
Like if a light flickers very, very fast, it looks like it's not flickering. It just looks like, that's what your TV does, I think. It's just a bunch of flickering, at least the old school TV, the cathode ray type TV.
It's like such a cool thing that you're talking about, and the way to like really, and there needs to be a word for the strange woozy feeling that comes from observing a thing from like 10 or 15 years ago and looking at it and realizing like this is fucking weird.
Have you been to my80stv.com?
No.
Or my70stv.com? No. Or my90stv? So it's just a TV on your browser and you have a channel flipper that you can go through, like, you know, the music station, the comedy station, the game show station, commercials, you can filter it out. But what you get to do is you get to see a whole decade in its entirety. And if someone stood out as like the best artist of that decade during that time, they still just sound like a 90s performer, or they just sound like an 80s performer. Yeah. It's got its own flavor. And the 2000s are, it hasn't settled yet. It's like wine or something. It's got to sit for a little bit before we look back and be like, oh yeah, the early 2000s did have a flavor, didn't it? And I'm sure this one does too. And
yeah, that
it's really fun to look at, especially commercials. Like in the 70s, there's a commercial for just Dove soap, like a bar of soap. And that's like the beginning of now there's a billion women's like soap products. You need this specific type of thing. Like there's never an ad for just buy this bar of soap and rub it on your body. That seems just so pedestrian.
Yeah.
Now it's, you need like 18 of them. But back then it was like, do you want to be beautiful? Then own soap. Use soap on your body.
Yeah. This is cool because, you know, we do this thing with like, what are they, ice cores, you know? You can like, or I actually just read this awesome.
What's ice cores?
Ice cores, when you pull up ice from the like ancient ice, you can look at the different layers of the ice and tell what the world was like, how what things were happening. Or another way to put it is sedimentary layers. Or I just read this awesome article about the magnetic shift that happens on the planet and how they figured this out by finding a stalactite. I always get them confused. I don't remember which is which. The stalagmite, stalactite problem. One comes from the ground. One comes from the roof of a cave. But
tight and might.
Tight and might.
Okay.
But also a wonderful comedy duo. They're fucking hilarious. But the iron filaments and these stalagmites or tights at some point change direction, that you can actually see the iron filaments changing direction based on the shift of the poles.
Do you know how often it shifts?
Well, that's one of the scary ideas. I think this one happened 150,000 years ago, 90,000 years ago. But I think one of the arguments is the shifting is slow in the sense, because in geologic time, over 150 years is not a long time.
Yeah.
So to see it shift that quickly is really like fucking weird, because all of our technology is based on the poles being a certain way. And if the shit shifted all of a sudden, then we would like a lot of what we use to run society would no longer function in the way we need it to function. So anyway, the point is these cultural stalactites, which are the digitized records of things that are on the internet now, actually show us the sort of cultural north and south. And we could see where the filaments were being drawn to, this thing or that thing, you know. And at that time, the influencers were people who had access to the technology, right? So NBC, ABC, CBS, Paramount, Warner Brothers, the studios, as they're called, these things, they had access to the tech, and the tech is the what creates the magnetism, which draws the culture, you know?
So, oh, yeah.
Right, right. And now we all have access to the tech. So we're dealing with all these fucking magnets that are all over the fucking place. Everybody's compass is going spinning around.
Yeah, there is no central thing anymore. And it's good.
It's good, but it's a little fucking confusing if you're somebody whose entire existence or modalities was, you know, being taught to you by the studios, by the state. That was another compass, you know, the school systems. You know, you go into school, it's a compass. It's like it's a, or rather it's a magnet. It's like, here's what's law. Here's what's good. Here's what's bad.
Yeah. This and that. But for the space cadets like you and I and listeners of this podcast, like, because I imagine at least 98% of listeners of this podcast are space cadets.
I don't know.
They've got to be. I think they're gonna be fine in the upcoming changes because we're already spaced out anyway and thinking about this stuff. But the people in like the very rigid state are having the most trouble with it.
Well, this is a problem because I was just having this great conversation with a friend of mine, Jason Louv. He's really cool.
Oh yeah, ultraculture.org. Talk to him.
We were chatting. You should have him on your show. He's wonderful. But we were talking about, you know, a thing that happens to people like us as space cadets, as you call them, when you're young. So you sort of like look around and you see people who are like in a deep hypnotic trance, right? Now you like to pretend you're not in one. You're in a different type of trance than they are, but at the time you're like, I'm not in that trance.
Yeah.
Classic cheesy movie example that I think really did just like impact a lot of us, sort of like psychedelic narcissists who all wanted to be Jesus at the time, was when Jim Morrison climbs on top of the car in the Doors movie and says, "You're all slaves." And we see that. We're like, "That's how I feel, man. You're right, Jim. They are slaves." Yep. But what we would do is we wouldn't get on the car. We'd go to the shopping malls, right? And we would like take acid and we'd look around at the people and they're sort of like materialistic hypnotic state where their bags are doing the mall walking thing and just experiencing the uncanniness of that level of consumerism through the lens of like LSD or whatever.
Yeah.
That's how we would do it, right? But the point is, on top of that, because we'd been given a kind of extra footing, so to speak, which is like we had untethered ourselves from the gravity well of whatever was being, you know, broadcast by the studios or by the corporations, we then had this extra little ability to sort of go to these people who were in a trance state and fuck with them, right?
Yeah.
And so for a lot of us, that, for me, this is what I was telling Jason, is like, I can remember, I was like, you know, just, I've been like doing a lot of like going back into my past and like thinking, remembering stuff, but one of the things I can remember
doing... Do you feel like it's coming back more? Like you're being able to remember more of your past as you get older?
Well, I'm... What it is like... Because now that both my parents are dead, I can free...
Finally.
I can free... It's weird. It's so... I'm glad you said it. For many people, that is the reaction.
That's just a joke. I mean, I just... Yeah.
Oh, God. It's not... I mean, the thing about it is...
The only reason I clarified a joke, because of course it's a joke, but I'm just wondering if it could be construed as like, oh, he wishes his parents are dead. Of course I don't wish my parents were...
Oh, well. I mean, yeah. Watch out, my friend. Explore that a little bit more. There's a... The thing is, we exist on so many different levels. How many times have you... I mean, I don't know if you ever did it, but certainly one thing that a toddler in the midst of a kid in a tantrum might yell at their mom or dad, "I wish you were dead."
Oh yeah, of course.
That's like saying cunt when you're a toddler.
I have a very clear memory of like telling my mom like, "You hate me," and like I remember her face like changing in that moment, because the toddler, or not toddler, but little me was anticipating her trying to convince, like, no, I, or, you know, coming back with something, but the amount at which it hurt her and, like, shocked her in that moment stuck me for, oh, man, forever. I'm like, oh, I'll never say that to anyone again. That's yeah. not a, that's, even though it's tiny, it's still manipulative and not good, and of course not true. Unless you do have one of those parents that, you know, the secret hating, there's a little bit of them, right? There's a term for it. It's an Italian term, like the mother that spites the that is mean to the kids to spite the father. There's like a specific old term for it. I don't know. If only Daniela Bolelli was here, he would maybe know it.
Oh, I mean, the variety of strange games being played in the human nests all around this planet, I think, are as infinite as grains of sand on the beach. There's so many different strange. I mean, when you say, you know, the look on my mom's face when I said, what is it she said to you?
I said to her, you hate me, because okay, she was trying to get me to practice violin, which is of course in my benefit.
Yeah, but you know, you, again, like, so now you've got this. So your mom looks, your mom hears that. This triggers all kinds of things in her, feelings of like, fuck, I must not be a good parent, or, oh my God, what am I doing wrong? Or all this stuff. She reacts, right? Yeah. But you see a thing that trembles in her face. You don't know what that's connected to. That could be connected to some memory of her mom, her dad. That could be connected to some past trauma. But because you're a little kid and you see that look on her face, you think, I have caused this ripple in the pond. You didn't cause it. You just said a certain thing. But you're a kid. Whatever you're saying, come on. Am I going to really take it that seriously?
Yeah.
You're shooting foam arrows, baby. It's like, the thing is, when that foam arrow hit your mom, it rippled the pond. You see the ripple. I must have done it. I'll never do that again. Because kids are hyper fucking sensitive, right? Anyway, yeah. The point is, all those little moments that happen to us, those little micro traumas that happen to us based on the way the environment reacts to us as children, form the way we act in the world, you know? Everybody's like, I want to look at my past lives.
Yeah, it's like, tough at first, but I'm drawn back to... This is when I first learned about who you were. I think it was early Joe Rogan Experience, and he's talking about how he let you stay at his place when you were going through a bad breakup or something, yeah, and you were going in his flotation tank for the first time, and you try to hide stuff from yourself, but if you're in that flotation tank, it's going to, especially if you eat an edible or something before, it's going to bring out every little thing from your past and show it to you, like, what's this thing? How come we haven't talked about this? What's this one? Ooh, this is a big juicy one. Let's talk about this. There's no escaping it.
Hi, I'm Paula Zahn, announcing the launch of On the Case, the podcast. Experience the most dramatic true crime investigations in a whole new way. Hear from loved ones on a relentless quest for justice and interviews with the detectives who piece together the mystery. On the Case with Paula Zahn, the podcast. Download it wherever you listen to podcasts.
You know, many people see these things as something to be avoided for their entire lives. And, or they have to avoid it because they can't look at it, you know, because it's like they're not ready to deal with it, you know. And I think probably at that phase, I was like summoning up a pretty idealistic idea of how memories work, or, you know, but...
You talking about flotation tank
Flotation tank.
Oh, okay, because I also want you to go back to when you were saying that your parents died, and then I said finally, and because I wanted you to finish that thought too, because I try to be a concept Sherpa and like revisit the stuff we might have missed case the listener is like, what happened to that thing that I was listening to a minute ago?
One thing I hope is by now my listeners know that, like, you never might, we could definitely end up in some weird tributary.
Yeah, it's Mr. Toad's Wild Ride for sure.
Who the fuck knows? But the essence of the thing is, and this is a concept I'm working with right now, and it does connect to your, finally, that your parents have died, which... By the way, you said it as a joke, but there are countless people on this very day whose mother or father has passed away after a long battle with this thing or that thing. And one piece of them is going, finally, for sure. And then that piece chirps up and they think that's all of them. And so they're like, my God, I must be a monster. It's like, no, that's just a piece of you. That's okay to think that. It's okay to think that, because that is a part of it. We do celebrate sometimes when our parents pass away, because the death is, for the living, a very, very, very difficult process, and there is a relief that comes. Now, anyway, that being said, and some people, man, they actually celebrate when their parents die because their parents were like abusers.
Yeah.
And there's a sense of being like freed, you know? So, the exploration of the past is our own personal past, I think, is a very, very worthwhile exploration, right? And I've been thinking about it in terms of inheriting a familial home.
Okay.
Dude, I love this fucking game, Darkest Dungeon. Have you played that game yet?
No. For what? Steam?
It's on Steam.
Okay. Is it new?
It's old. It's an old RPG. It's an old Lovecraftian horror RPG where you go back home. You've been summoned back to your familial home, this old decrepit fucking like manor house, and you have to go into the dungeons and the attics and the forests and gather up relics and heirlooms that have somehow become scattered all about. After
and you don't know what's going on. You don't really know what you're.
You figure it out as it happens, but it's a classic H.P. Lovecraft shit. It's like, you know, it's really, really what I love so much about the game is it's incredibly difficult, and you get one life. So you have all these various characters. When they die, they're dead. You don't get them back. It saves on the cloud. The fucking guys are dead. So, but then also what I like about it is the encounters that happen.
Can you say that again? It goes in, they go in the cloud after you die. You
well,
get a random
Steam saves it. You don't see you it, like, in other words, like, you're not auto saving.
But which guy dies? Your player?
Well, you assemble parties. So you have this never ending roster of people who keep coming into the town in a caravan to try to make money helping you do this work of essentially.
Oh, so it's trying to set it up that if a person dies, it's like that actual randomly generated person is gone. Okay,
well,
I like that.
You know, you just one life. You have one life. It's a game where you have one life. You don't
like
get
that
to go back. So any fucking decision you make is permanent. But then also the characters, they go insane. Right, so because there's stress of seeing these horrific beings in the shadows there, they actually start losing their fucking minds, and you have to put them in like mental asylums, and you have to like, they get diseased. It's just a fun game, right? But I love that game, not just because it's fun, but because it's like, when you begin to go down into your past, it's very similar. You're going back, there's all these relics scattered in your past, right?
Yeah.
And a lot of those relics are buried underneath layers of amnesia, layers of shit that intentional distraction from people in your life who didn't want you to remember that or see it because it's so bad.
Yeah.
Or just, you know, protective membranes constructed by your psyche because you can't deal with it. And so this is the thing, man. You know, so many people are going to hypnotists or doing their own meditative practices to try to remember their past lives while not going into their own fucking life's past. I was like, dude, who gives a fuck if you were Napoleon? How about the fucking fact that, you know, when you were 11 years old, you were exposed to hardcore pornography? How about that? How did that fucking...
Yeah, as opposed to 7, which is when you're supposed to get it nowadays.
But no, you know what I mean? So like, that's a personal anecdote. Like, so the exploration of the past is a very scary for some people. It is like taking a lantern and going down.
Do you ever, how far back have you gone personally? Do you ever end up uncovering stuff that like, wow, I thought the earliest I could remember was 3, but it turns out I have a little bit of a memory when I'm 2.
Now that my parents have passed, I'm like able to like open this vault up and really go deep down in there. So it's like, I can like tell you the exact.
You mean just mentally or going through objects?
So, like, I can, like, I've actually been sort of charting it out. I think I have it here somewhere. I've like, gotten back to, I was born in 1974. So, I can get back to right around, you know, with scattered memories here or there, 1982.
Okay.
And then I can sort of, like...
Wait, 6 is your earliest memory?
What's that? I think I was eight, right?
Eight's your earliest?
Well, not earliest. I've got early, early ones, okay. Right? But eight's where it all starts getting real clear. That's when the divorce happened. Before that, it's a big old fucking fog. Scary fog, too. So that's what I'm kind of like working on. Like,
are you an only child?
Brother.
That's right.
What
okay.
about you? Are your parents together?
Brother. Yeah, they're together.
So your parents have been together your whole life?
Uh-huh.
Wow. Okay, cool. Yeah. That's
I remember a couple of like serious fights, but never like not, I think there's bickering sometimes, but it's never like anything more than you'd see in any other marriage. But I've had together parents. It's been good in that sense.
Good. And did you guys move around a lot?
We moved from Sarnia, Ontario to Edmonton, Alberta in Canada, then all the way to Lake Jackson, Texas. Then I went to college in Austin, Texas, then here in LA. So I had like half Canada and then half like small town.
Why the move?
Dad's job.
What was the job?
Chemical engineer for Dow Chemical.
Wow, cool. Your dad's smart. Your parents are smart. Is your mom a scientist? Uh-huh.
Yeah, my mom's got a PhD in physics, actually, but she ended up not doing that, which is funny because I always try to talk to her about quantum physics stuff because I'm, like I said, space cadet, and I'll watch like a Nassim Haramein holofractal like 2-hour lecture about why, you know, the proton is the jewel of Indra's net and like why cool. all the information in the proton is the same as the whole thing, and I like try to show her this thing. It's like, have you seen this? Have you seen that we're all? But she's just much more into Newtonian, like material science, like cares more about that, and I'm just so much more woo-woo, so it's always this interesting dynamic. It tests my knowledge of that woo-woo, because it's easy to watch something, whether it's pyramid stuff or holofractal or simulation theory, and then be inspired by it and have it light you up, and then to go talk to someone who hasn't seen that video, try to relay what you just saw to them, that tests what your understanding of it is. And it's good for you.
Especially when it's a fucking physicist. I mean, it's like, it's not like you're going to your, you know what I mean? It's not like you're going to your friends and like relaying some shit. It's like somebody who's got a trained scientific mind.
Yep.
Who's going to hear whatever it is that you have to say and like look at it and like, I don't know, man. Like, let's explore it a little deeper. And then the next thing you know, it's like, oh shit, I don't understand it. It just sounds cool, right?
But I think it's there. You can stand in two places. You can stand in the material and it's real, or you can stand in the ethereal or spiritual or whatever the word you want to call it, the not material. And they're both just as real as the other, but they're on opposite sides of the coin. So if you're standing on one, you're not standing on the other. You know that Joseph Campbell quote where it's at the end of a long thing, but he goes like, are you the light shining out of the bulb, or are you the bulb? And I asked that to my mom, and she's like, the bulb. And I was like, oh, it's so funny that you'd pick the bulb as the answer and not the light shining out of the bulb.
Do you remember when you were coming up, your parents explaining to you the scientific method, or did you, when they were teaching you as a child, did they like try to impart a kind of rationalistic approach to interpreting reality?
Not overly. Like, I guess we would, they wouldn't try to like push religion away because there wasn't like a lot of religious like coming into me. I guess there was just kind of nothing. But my mom loved Carl Sagan, and they just loved sci-fi and books. And we had a telescope and would look at the stars and be like, that's Jupiter. And that's like, you know, 100,000 times bigger. No, it's not 100,000 times bigger than Earth. Whatever size bigger than Earth it is, they would describe that. And then I think when I started to meet religious people, or when I went to Bible camp for a few weeks because I was staying with family friends, and then we went to this Bible camp thing, and when I'm learning all these new concepts of like, God is everywhere, God can hug you right now, if you reach out your arms you can hug God. And then I remember going to my dad and asking like, what's all this stuff here? And then he had to say like, yeah, don't tell anybody this, but I'm what they call an atheist.
Holy
so
shit.
I don't believe in that stuff, but people are sensitive about it, and you know, no one knows the answer. So I mean, he's really wise philosophically and is into poetry and Rumi
dad.
And all that kind of stuff. Oh,
what
yeah, the
a great
best.
Dad.
Yeah.
Holy shit. What a perfect response. I'm putting that in the fucking soon to be a dad bank.
Oh, yeah. Do you think about like, I mean, really, there's not much you can do, but there's so many parents thinking about, like, how am I going to stop my kids from seeing, you know, adult things? How am I going to stop them from seeing porn or violence? Like, I don't know, man.
I'm gonna do that.
How?
Sew their eyes shut. I'm going to cover my child's head with a sackcloth.
What about in 2032 when they can transmit images directly into the brain, not through the retinal cavity?
2032?
Yeah.
You know,
probably sooner. I'm just giving that ballpark.
I'm going to use a quadrivium lance to disrupt his synaptic cleft to prevent him from receiving any kind of data from the...
He just blocked that with a level 3 cloak of fuck you, dad.
Yeah, well, I know. I've already thought about that.
That's going to be so cool. Just, I mean, you've probably already thought of all this, but he gets a record... Your son that's not even born yet, which he's maybe just floating around in the DMT world or something right now. He exists, just he hasn't come into, or the soul is in the womb, or who knows the things. But he has so much record of his father speaking. Like, there's you on record saying, yeah, we're trying to have a kid right now. And then there's you on record on a podcast going, like, yeah, and we're going to have a kid now. And he's got a record of him talking to his grandma that he never got to meet with his dad. That's super cool. He's got all this. He probably won't care when he's 7 or 9 or something. But, oh, man, like, when he's... little bit older, that's a big like treasure trove of like, look at all these conversations of like, we don't have that. You and I don't have that.
No, we don't. I mean, we do have it. It's just the way we have it is in a different form, but it's
like 7 black and white photos or something.
I think it's like epigenetics and like there's a way to like commune with them probably, but it's the trick I'm trying to use when it comes to my son is to be in the moment. And so the mind wants to prognosticate, well, fuck, what am I going to do when he's a teenager? What am I going to do when he wants to drive? What am I going to do if he like wants to play football? What am I going to do? You know, all these things the mind...
You know, George Harrison's son was in military school and like that drove his dad quite crazy. Just that...
All of it. Yeah, all the potential things. But I keep thinking like, well, if there's a one thing... I would love to impart on him is the wonderful quality of the present moment. And that we can plan, and it's good to plan, but it's better to be like in this place, you know? And to teach that, you have to be in it as much as you can. So that's one thing is like, I just, you know, when my mind starts thinking about this shit, it's just like, let's just be here right now.
Yeah.
And then when I'm with my wife, you know, and I'm laying with her and I'm like talking to her to my son through her belly, you know, it's like I'm here now, we're here now, and then, or you know, this is where we are now.
Yeah.
And then that's what it is. And otherwise, man, I'm gonna freak the fuck out. The idea of some goddamn teen standing...
Yeah, you can't operate in that way. And we all know, not all of us, but I guess you and I know that we have to be here now and it's all about the present moment. But like, I'm sure you experienced the fading of that stuff, right? Like the first time you read Be Here Now and you read about Bhagwan Das telling him like, don't worry about the future, be here now. Don't worry about the past, be here now. And then it resonates with you. But then after a few months, that book's on your shelf and you're having trouble being here now, even though the book says be here now and it's got all the...
Well, that's an interesting thing to bring up, which is, you know, I think of this in terms of... this is when the gravy is congealed, right? So, like, we've got this wonderful... it's kind of a gross example.
Scoot, do it. You talking slime.
Gravy congeals. It, like, you get a gravy... If, like, you're at somebody's Thanksgiving dinner and they got gravy and it's been sitting there too long, it gets this gross film on the top, right? And so when it comes to ideas of the present moment or be here now or any of that shit, the shit congeals in your mind. So it's like, you're like, I don't even know what that even, you don't even know what it means anymore.
Yeah.
Because it's because the present moment is now. It's not the present moment that you experienced 2 years ago. Like that present moment, this is now, now.
This one rules.
Yeah, this is
I'm on the DTFH.
Yeah.
I'm literally on the DTFH right now.
Yeah.
And listener, you're listening to the DTFH. That's like, that's a good moment right there. You found an episode.
We're here. Yeah, exactly. And that thing, you know, it, like finding it is it's like a wonderful Easter egg hunt, which is like all this right now is fucking cool, man. I'm getting to hang out with you. I'm here in my studio. It's nice. It's, but you know, at some point, turbulence will come, right? And it'll seem crazy, and all these things will happen to us, and our minds are going to be pulled in a million different directions. Yeah. In that place, we go back. Wait, I think, oh, here it is again. And Ding. Then you find it. Yeah, right? But it's just, this is now. And this now is so wonderful. And this now is actually all you got. Like, Marcus Aurelius, have you read any Marcus Aurelius?
I've seen Gladiator. Is that what you're referring to?
Is Marcus Aurelius the emperor in Gladiator?
Isn't he? I thought he was the Russell Crowe character, but I'm a dumbass.
Oh, no. Marcus Aurelius was an emperor. No, you're not a dumbass.
But it's funnier to say that, you know.
Talk about your art yet, man. But, like, Marcus Aurelius is a Stoic philosopher emperor guy who...
Was Max Aurelius the guy? I don't know.
I don't know. For some reason, I did enjoy Gladiator, but I can't remember too much of it. Now
doesn't seem like he'd quote, or it doesn't seem like he's the quote kind of guy. It's more like the silent, wise kind of guy. But go on, what's his quote?
Well, the quote is more like, it's not, the idea is like, this frame that you're in right now is it. This is it. This is where you're at. And so a lot of people get really connected to, one thing that I, in the past, have been very, really stupidly thought is when I die, I lose my past. So when I was conceiving death, I was conceptualizing death as the complete extinguishment or collapse of all the other moments that have passed, right?
Yeah.
Now this is absolutely insane because those moments have already passed. They're gone.
Yeah.
And people can think of death and like, I'm going to lose it all. No, no, it's gone. You're dead. It died. It's gone. Bye-bye. It's gone. It's just stored up in your mind. Now what there is this moment. And then there's your mind, right? And the mind is going into this vast library or familial mansion, right? And it's pulling out books. And it's reading the books into the present moment.
Yeah.
This is the plan what you are. Social security number, your name, and what you like, and who you did, and how it happened. And oh, fuck, you're going to get fucked when you do that thing. Why'd you say it? What did you do? You know, that's the temple of the self, is these weird monks pulling down strange tomes that have been written neurologically and stored in this archive. And they're pulling the fucking tomes out, and they're like, there's a person who's going to hurt you. Don't you see the pattern you're in? Don't trust that person. This reminds me of the person who did the thing. Right? And so that's what we're doing. We're basically dropping these colored neurological memory drops into the present moment.
Yeah.
And that is what defines us as a being. Right? So anyway.
I like that a lot. You've heard a lot of Eckhart Tolle, right?
Yeah.
The one that helped me a lot was the way he described that anything in the future, even if it's in the future 100 years from now or 10 weeks from now or whatever, is going to be experienced as the present moment, no matter which place you're in. Everything you experience is as present moment. So if you don't train to do that, then you're not going to do well in the other one. So there's only one place you can train.
That's it. This is it.
Oh, man.
And you know, to like the Marcus Aurelius, the Stoics, they remind us of that. So it's just like this reminder of like, okay.
Why are they called Stoics? Because they just sat and thought?
Great fucking, no, the term Stoic is that thing that comes after. I don't know why they ended up calling Stoicism what it is. It was like a whole branch of philosophy that like, I always thought of as like, oh, that must mean it's austere, but it seems to be more, it reminds me a lot of like Greek Buddhism or Greek Taoism. You know, it's just more based on like, but it's, the weird thing is Marcus Aurelius, I think, tortured Christians, but I'm not sure.
Oh, good. But, no, just kidding. See, going with the parent dead thing again. It's the easiest and kind of most fun, if you're around the right people, thing. And I guess Jim Norton does it a lot. He's not the only one, but it's just the, anytime anyone says anything, just if you say the most horrible thing you can think of just immediately afterwards, it's like, you know, if someone's saying like, oh, what should I do this afternoon? Hang yourself. Yeah. That's Mitzi or Gary Shandling.
Can't kill yourself. Yeah, that thing, the Darkling trip. It's dude, I did that for a while. I still do it sometimes. Like, it's fun to, like, you know, pull out a dead cat in the middle of the party or whatever. And then it's just like, I have to analyze my intentions behind it. You know, it's like, it's okay to pull a dead cat out, though. I and some people are really good at it. I like, particularly Jim Norton, man. Like, when to see the hissing horror in the eyes of people who have been offended by one of Norton's characters, or just general sense of disease, or like when you, if you're lucky enough and you get offended by Jim Norton, you know, like if that moment happens where you're actually like, oh no, this is unspeakable.
Yeah.
That's a joy. You know, I love that feeling, but yeah, that queasy feeling is so cool. And someone's a master at like administering that sense of nausea, whatever you want to call it. It's fucking cool, man. But something that I am perplexed about, because you're so many different things, you know, and I only understand some of them. One of them in particular, your art. Holy fucking shit, man.
Oh, thank you.
You have produced a really beautiful way of transmitting what I consider to be the great data. It sounds so cheesy to say.
No, keep going.
Dharma, you know, through your art. And the way you're doing it is, I think, skillful means, you know, which is that when I'm looking at your art and I'm reading the points that you're making, I don't feel like you're being sanctimonious. You know, I feel like it makes sense. It's inspiring. And what's really, the other thing that I find quite beautiful about it is it's simple. It's really not a complex, the equations you're presenting to us are very, very simple, which to me is the most difficult thing to do. There's not a lot of fucking like fat there, you know?
Yeah, it's difficult in the getting in your own way part of it. Like, it's the easiest thing to do if you actually get there and find the thing, because we all have it inside of us, the deep, I mean, sometimes they call it shower thoughts or something, but like we all have that, or maybe we don't. I don't know. Some people maybe just have nothing going on, but
what are you creating? What is the medium you're using
to make what, the images?
Yeah.
I draw them by hand and I color them in Photoshop and sometimes clean them up a little bit if I screw up the ink drawing, but just ink pen on paper, scan using my phone. Used to use a printer scanner, and then I discovered the phone scans at 600 DPI, so just scan it in like that and then color it.
Which came first, stand up or the art?
Oh, art, because I've just always, I started, so I've played violin since I was 5, and I've drawn cartoons since, I guess, also that age. So I used to just be all about music and then was just doodling a lot in classes. And I didn't start doing like comic books till college, and I started drawing a strip called Strippy for my university newspaper, and they used to pay me, I think, like $10 a strip. And that's, I remember cool, thinking like, oh man, it's easier for me to draw one of these than it would be to draw a $10 bill. That'd be like really hard to draw a $10 bill. So I can draw my own type of $10 bills. Bad. And it wasn't just for money, but I liked that I did that. And I had an audience. This was pre like social media. So I would put it out. People would read that newspaper. I'd have my email there. So if people really liked it, sometimes they'd reach out through email or something. So I got that going, and stand up happened after I got a DWI. I didn't get an actual one, but I got pulled over for drunk driving and I had to go to the jail for 24 hours. Wasn't convicted of it. Got
which jail?
The Travis County Jail in Austin, Texas.
How many people were in there with you?
30. There was one guy I was chained to for like 12 hours, and then I got unchained from him, and I got to have my own cell. That was the best part, because then I got to be in my own place. The worst part was just thinking about like having to tell my parents about it, which I was already independent from them, but I didn't want to hide it from them either.
Still just sucks.
Yeah, and I called my dad, the next day, and I told him that, yeah, are you sitting down? I got something bad to tell you. And he's like, sure. And I said, I got arrested last night. I got a DWI charge, and I was in jail for the last 24 hours. And then the first thing he says is, did you give breath test? And then I go, yeah, I breathed because I thought I was under. And he goes, you never give these bastard evidence. That's the first thing he said. It's just, you don't ever give these bastards evidence.
Right.
And yeah, that was a good lesson.
How'd you get off the hook?
Off the hook of the thing? Oh, that was my blood alcohol level was just so close to the legal limit. It was just barely over. So if I pled no contest, and because I was young and no criminal record and, you know, an upstanding citizen of blah, blah. I guess technically I'm white then, right? If I can get off like that. I joke about, it's an old Patrice O'Neill joke about like how there's different white people, like how Japanese are the white people of Asians and, you know, Persians are the white people of Middle Eastern people.
Right.
So, I mean, I've had,
think if you were like more complected, you would have been fucked.
I think so. I think it's been, shown. Not that you're always fucked. I'm sure there's like
just
plenty
the probability
of
goes up.
Yeah. And there's great cops too. I mean, not to go down all that rabbit hole, but just, you know, you hear about a gang shooting. Like I heard someone recently was in an Uber. I don't want to out their name or anything, but their Uber driver was shot in the head because of a gang drive-by. And, you know, we spent all this time being like, oh, stupid cops and like just power tripping bad things. And then you hear about gang shooting random innocent Uber driver. And it's like, okay, yeah, it is kind of good to have cops sometimes. But then there's the argument of like, yeah, the gangs wouldn't have to do that if the cops weren't. And then it's the endless cycle
of gangs wouldn't have to do it. Gangs wouldn't have to shoot Uber drivers if there were no cops?
Well, that wouldn't exist if there wasn't
the
drug.
What a weird gang.
Yeah.
We gotta keep killing these Uber drivers until it's fucking anarchy.
No Lyft drivers, only Uber. But that whole tangent of stand-up started because I got the DWI, and then in the jail cell, like, I had a lot of time to think about what I was doing with my life. It's like, is this really what I want to do? Just work. I was at the time doing web development, so just web developing and then going out at night with friends and drinking and then driving home. It's like, that's a stupid life. That's not what I want to do here. It's like, what do I want to do? And then, like, at the time, stand-up seemed like this impossible one. Like, I was a musician, but I wasn't a comic. That takes, like, how does that even work? How do you even start? Where do you go? And then me and my friend, my best friend in the whole world, Mike Sears, was, you know, he sat with me by a river, and we had a long talk about stand-up. We decided to start stand-up together. We were like, we'll just go to this open mic, and if there's no one there, great. If everyone's there, great. If it's, who cares? We'll just see what it is. And it turned out to be just the best night of the whole year. Who knows if it was a shitty night? Maybe I wouldn't have done stand-up, but it was packed, and not everyone was doing well. Like, half the people were doing well. There was, like, a few standouts. I remember Doug Mellard. If you don't know Doug Mellard, he was one of the guys that stood out to me. Brendan Walsh was there at the time in Austin. Brendan was like in the big kids table. Like, it was that table of like, oh, those are the seniors. You don't go sit at that table. Like, that's the big scary ones. And then, you know, you start doing the open mics, and then the open mics turn into MC spots, turn into feature spots. Eventually you get to headline off nights. And then one day you wake up and you're like, oh shit, I'm at that table, and Brendan and them are, they haven't lived here in years. How did I become sitting at this table?
Right.
And then you grow from even sitting at that table to leaving your home base. Mine was Austin. Some people's, it might be Portland, Seattle, Chicago, Dallas, anywhere. And then you move out and start over pretty much. If you move to New York or LA, you kind of have to start over because there's just too much good talent and...
Yeah,
there's
not enough spots.
No one's going to call you up like, hey, we need someone to fill this spot. No, that's filled. You got to reach out to people about it.
I'm fascinated by that. You know, this is when I was really getting into VR, that was a thing I kept thinking. It's like, whoa, man, this is going to redefine so many artistic industries. And you know, we're not there yet.
In 10 years, it'll hit scale. That's what Gary Vee says and some other people.
10 years?
Yeah, like a lot of people are jumping on it now the same way that, you know, the phone took a little while to become mainstream. Now you have to really, it's weird if you don't have a smartphone. Someone's a kook if they're like, well, I've got a phone, but it's not a smartphone. I have a,
Well, the problem though with stand-up in particular is sound. It's like, it's not so much, it is, it's a lot of things, but there, you know, clearly the problem is like getting across, like,
yeah, Todd Glass could do a whole number on the, you know, how specific he is about the mic sound. Setup, oh the God. Audience setup, yeah. The ceiling's got to be low. Right. The,
he gets it all
yeah,
tuned.
The lighting.
He's like a stage tuner. He doesn't just play the piano. He fucking tunes it, and he tunes it in this great way. It's, I love that. I love that. He's right, too. But it's like, the technologically, one of the problems with it is that if you're going to perform for a virtual audience, these are all people who are in different places all over the planet. And they all have different mics, and they all have different ways of transmitting sound.
You're talking about doing stand-up in a VR setting?
Yeah. Yeah. If like, because, you know, what you're talking about there, the moving, the, so there's the pilgrimage that inevitably happens for the stand-up comic, which is that before you're ready, or too late, or just when you're ready, whatever. You
yeah.
get the call, and you drive to New York, or you moved to New York, you moved to LA to begin to like refine your talent. And so that is a huge, that's a mystical journey. That pilgrimage is a mystical pilgrimage for so many comics. I mean, it really is truly a like fucking holy goddamn
yeah,
drive.
I remember the plane flight over here, just seeing that grid of lights, like the, now I'm used to it, but the grid of LA lights stretches as far as the eye can see, and just everywhere else it's like, oh, there's the city, but here it's like, where is the city? It's this whole span of yeah, everything.
Yeah, and those beginning months or years, and the feeling of like, whoa, what the yeah. fuck am I doing?
The first year is worthless, and the first three are kind of worthless. I feel like I've just yeah. kind of found my stride here, and
it's a beautiful path, and it's a scary path for a lot of people. But like, when you know, I love thinking about technological disruption,
yeah,
and particularly, you know, like the place I live at. You know, we just gotta, you know, one of the problems is the Waze has determined that this is like a throughway. So suddenly a street that maybe at one point didn't have a lot of people, now it's got a river of cars going up it.
That's weird because it's such a hilly area.
Yeah. And
you wouldn't think it is, but I guess Waze doesn't factor that in.
It happened, right? And then on top of that, so we see that's a technological disruption. And so many... To get back to the idea of like history being a fucking
basketball yeah.
on the bouncing on the fucking floor of time, the gymnasium of time or whatever.
The gymnasium of time.
Now we're seeing all these like other forms of technology, like almost any crazy problem that's happening in the world right now is in some way, shape or form related to disruptions being caused by interconnectivity. And so when it comes to comedy, stand-up comedy in particular, it is only a matter of time before the technology emerges where you could put on a show in VR space that is indistinguishable from a show in actual space. We can't do it right now.
Yeah.
Because you can't, there's no fucking way to create some unified microphone field for the audience. So if you want to know what, like, next time you go on stage, apply some mindfulness to how important not just how you sound is, but your ability to hear the audience. And you realize, like, you're doing some very deep listening. You're listening to shuffles and rustles, and you, like, you know, you're listening to something very deep, which is the sound of a unified crowd.
Yeah, right? And especially like the different scales of it. You understand this better than I do, probably, because you've gone on the road with Rogan and stuff, like seeing those like thousands of people audiences and the way you have to change yourself and your timing to fit within those waves of laugh as opposed to like a room with 300. Did you find yourself having to really like recalibrate, like, oh, I wasn't expecting that, like,
yeah,
big amount of love
all,
energy.
Not just fucking giant rooms, little rooms, all rooms. There's always a kind of like my, like, summary, like, it's like it's surfing or it's a wave, and you feel like you're, it's a temporal wave made up of a gestalt, so to speak. And so you've got to sort of like, you know, you're always going to be within that wave and attuned to it in some way, but you don't want to attune too much to it, because now you're like you know, that's when you fall into like the realm of saying what you think they want to hear. And it's like, don't fucking do that. But then don't fall too outside of it. I'm not going to say what they want to hear and like do like sort of like unskillful Jim Norton style things, which is like, no, I'm just going to fucking just say whatever I want. By the way, that's not a Jim Norton job. He's good at it. When people aren't good at that, Jesselnik, good at it.
Yeah.
When people aren't good at it, and it's like, wait, you're just doing the opposite of saying what
it's
they
a tightrope, man. If you're if you miss it a little bit, you suck. But if you nail it, like, yeah, Jesselnik nails it.
There's nothing more. Well, there's so many annoying things, but it's very annoying. And I think any of these things I'm allowed to say because I've been it at some point. But there's nothing more annoying than seeing a fucking unfunny edgelord on stage who's like burping out some bullshit, offensive, quote, offensive shit. And people aren't laughing. And then they say, I know why you're not laughing. It's because you're afraid to laugh. That used to, I've seen it so many times.
Yeah.
You're just afraid to, no, they're not afraid to laugh. It's not funny.
I never did that on stage, but I was guilty of it internally where like a booker or something would be, you know, upset with me for doing a particular joke on a showcase night, and I was like really defensive. I'm like, what, it did well, and like, what, George Carlin said this and this and this and this, and now looking back on it, it's like, oh, did you, a stupid 4-year in comic, just compare yourself to to do that because George Carlin did it? Fuck you, you piece of shit.
One of the signs whenever I'm comparing myself to George fucking Carlin, it's time to just fucking stop and get the notebook out and start writing.
Fuck you, eat your own ass.
It just is like, so that kind of ability to attune yourself to the audience, and then from that attunement understand sort of the shape of the canvas and then paint your own painting. This is, you know, it takes a lot of different input variables, and the sound is crucial. So like with doing shows in virtual reality space, to attune yourself to avatars, to attune yourself to people who are like potentially, you know, sitting on their mattress, you know.
Yeah. Or what if even farther, they're occupying, like one time you had a ginger man watching you, a gingerbread man watching you. What if his ear is like, it takes in sound differently through those gingerbread man ears to the to the receiver? It's like, oh, I got to speak in a lower tone so he can hear me.
That's it. But one day, all these will be worked out, because live performance is, you know, such a massive fucking industry. And if suddenly you could, in whatever particular performance field you're in, create a infinitely large venue to perform within and charge tickets for it and not leave your house.
Infinitely large venue.
Yeah, dear Christ.
Did you see Maria Bamford's last special, Old Baby?
I haven't seen it.
She starts performing in front of a mirror, so it's just her. Then it's her in front of her parents in their living room. Then it's her in front of a park bench with like four friends. Then it's in front of just a little like coffee shop, just a few people. Then it's in a like small divey club. Then she's performing in front of a comedy club, a big one. Then she's performing in a theater.
Genius.
Then she's performing in an arena. And then finally she's like out in the galaxies, like just performing in front of it all.
Fucking genius. She's so smart.
Yeah, she's one of the greatest. And her reasoning for that was that she said a friend saw her do the exact same set with the same, you know, kind of response. But when she saw her during the coffee shop, she was like, and then when she saw her in the theater, it's like, whoa, that was something else. That was really good, when it was in fact the same thing, but she was influenced by the amount of people laughing at it. That's what made it feel like it was
That
better
phenomena. And it's like, now it's so curious, because it's like, shit, man, when, you know, stand up was, you know, growing and evolving, or when any kind of performance was growing and evolving, in the early days, this stage was the most advanced technology. That was advanced technology.
Yeah.
Getting on stage and having props or lights or any kind of like, you know, artificial lighting or anything like that, that was cutting edge, right? So now what we're seeing, and it kind of goes back to this, like what we were talking about in the beginning, is that now the stage is appearing everywhere. Now it's fucking Instagram. Now it's your podcast. Now it's your tweets. Now it's your Facebook.
Yeah.
And there's the physical stage. And there's the stage. So now what we're witnessing is like this thing is happening, which I just read. It's a great term. Opticon. Have you ever heard of that?
No. What do you mean?
So an opticon is a name for a type of fascist state where everyone's watching everyone else. It's called an opticon.
That sounds great.
Well, it's great unless the people who are watching you are also simultaneously turning you in or, like, you know, snitching on you.
But if everyone can see everything, then the truth is, right? Then there's no distortion of the truth.
Opticon would be fantastic.
Isn't that what Bitcoin is, essentially? And isn't that what Indra's Net is, essentially, too? It's that if everyone is watching everyone, everyone has the data of everyone else.
Well, no, I think Indra's Net, Bitcoin, you could say, are more related to the concept of dependent origination, right?
Okay.
So, like, everything's connected to everything else. One part of the net trembles, all the net trembles, right? And this is like goes back to this cultural magnetic filament thing, which is that the net tremblers formerly were the studios, formerly were the TV shows, the musicians, and who had, but to tremble the net, you needed to have an amplification device powerful enough to tremble the fucking net, right? And now we all have the amplification device to tremble the fucking net.
Yeah.
So we're all net tremblers, right? We're all like blasting the net. Now we don't need to get on stage. We don't need to go to Madison Square Garden anymore. You could literally upload a thing. You could turn the camera on and upload something that just popped into your head. You know, you could upload a thing and say it, life is suffering. The cause of suffering is attachment. Get rid of attachment, suffering ends. To get rid of attachment, here's a path I've come up with. You know, you could say the four.
This message is brought to you by attachment. That's the pre-roll in the middle of it.
I'm saying, like, when the Buddha, you know, gains realization under the Bodhi tree and spreads the four noble truths of Buddhism, it took a long time for that data field to sort of get around the planet. It's just now getting around the planet.
Yeah,
know?
The popcorn has started to actually, like, there's less space in between each kernel popping off.
A more negative way to put it is when fucking Mel Gibson, you know, like, gets drunk and we realize he's, like, in some way, shape, or form apparently completely anti-Semitic, right?
Is that recent or from 10 years ago?
It happened a while ago.
Oh, really?
You know, he's, like, bitching about the Jews or whatever. He's all hammered, and it's, like, the amount of time it took for Mel Gibson's, like, anti-Semitism to echo around the planet was approximately 24 hours, where if Mel Gibson's carriage had crashed and he'd started screaming about the Jews in the 1600s, there isn't a single soul in England that's going to know about that until a fucking ship makes the voyage and someone gets off the ship and is like, have you heard?
Yeah.
Actor Mel Gibson hates the Jews.
And that's a good thing back then, too,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
Just being anti.
Like, yeah, that's right.
Who was talking about, I'm trying to articulate this right. You know Onyx Ashanti? Just super futurist guy, but I won't even go into it. Just look up the guy. I was trying to relay something he was saying about how no matter how far into the future we go, if there's any way of distinguishing one thing from another thing, there will be, like, basically there's no end to racism. But you can help it, but there's always going to be that sense of racism or tribalism or something. You can't completely extinguish it because that's just what.
Interesting.
Yeah.
That's a pretty big prediction. It's like any kind, this is the other thing. It's like any of these future predictions, it's like, who the fuck knows? And that's why I love this Stoic concept or
yeah.
Ram Dass's teachings, which is like, all right. Okay. So, like, let's just get back here again. Right. And I think that in the same way, there's an imperative that you begin to realize, if you're me, later on in your life, to, like, figure out a way to find that moment, the jewel in the heart of the lotus, to find that moment again and again. Not because it's, like, cool or it makes you feel better because it's going to, like, you know, make you, like, a better person or make you sexier or whatever. But the reason it's like, good to do that is because every time you land in that spot, you're going to be far more adept at reducing suffering than you are if you're not in that spot, right?
Yeah, you can just get a little better.
Yeah.
Something else about that, when you were talking about Madison Square Garden, you can just make it happen now. It's that It used to be that way, like with photographs, like only the rich had a photograph of themselves or a portrait of themselves. Yeah. Now, like, think of how many different artistic portrayals of your face you've seen. Have you even seen all of them? Like, oh, just on, I don't know. There's probably people who've drawn your face. There's more than you can count by now.
That thing. Yeah.
That's like, happens. That's ridiculous. And that's happening to everyone across the board now. Before, like, you would have to
infinite digitization.
And now, like, you need to be Amy Schumer or Kevin Hart or something to perform at Madison Square Garden. And that's going to be just, well, anyone can perform it in front of a million people if you wanted to. That's going to be an equalizer.
The potential is always there for you to get sucked into an updraft where suddenly the thing you're doing is being broadcast to the entire planet. And this is the opticon, as they say, which is that, and this happens, you see some, you know, fucking pilled up, hopped up, hyper racist at a gas station in fucking Alabama yelling at some complected person to get the fuck out of the country. And that comes on, that gets filmed. And now that person gets in. That person is forever radiating out as an example of yet of true racism. And we see it and we're like, what the fuck? It's horrifying.
Yeah.
Right? So I guess my point is this present moment idea, it's wonderful, not just because it makes us relaxed, but because at some point, someone is going to have like an epiphanous moment derived from the present moment, right?
Yeah.
And the difference between that person and the Buddha is that that person is going to make the announcement on Instagram. They're going to make the announcement here or there in some way. And in the same way the magnetic field of the Earth shifts over 150 years and not thousands of millions of years, it's going to shift the cultural landscape instantaneously.
Right? Yeah, it's already doing it.
Yeah. So I just feel like there's a really good, like, my theory behind it is like, well, it's what Neem Karoli Baba said, which is like, we do this thing we're doing right now, not necessarily because of what it's going to do for us, but how it helps other people.
Do you think he meant what he said to Ram Dass when he said, like, don't tell people about me, don't talk about me? Do you think that was a little, like, trickster in him going, like, of course you're going to talk about me. If I say don't talk about me, it's going to want you to do it even more.
He's a very funny man.
Yeah.
He's a very
Some of those
man.
Stories are so, like, I mean, I'm not a critic of it because I believe it. I think there's crazier things than to have an old man in a blanket be magical and be the reincarnation of Hanuman or however you want to describe it, his cities, his all that. But I love reading the stories of, you know, well, I'd never met Neem Karoli Baba, and one day I went to his ashram and he didn't talk to me the whole day, and I was about to fly back to the States, and then as I was packing my bags, he showed up at the door and there was an aura around him. He was just kind of lit up. He was glowing. And then the next thing I knew, he was in front of me and he just slapped the top of my head and just started beating the shit out of me. And you're just like, oh my God, who is this awful man? And I just started tearing up. I just started crying more than I've ever cried in my whole life. And then I just wanted to touch his feet. And it's just such strange accounts like that, that if you told someone that didn't already know about, you know, Ram Dass and the mix of it, if you told just that story in isolation, it's like, who the fuck is this guy? I think that's Bhagwan Das's story of Neem Karoli. I think I might be misplacing it, but Bhagwan Das is the big, you know, beard guy with who's the guy who said be here now. Actually, he's the guy telling Ram Dass be here now. And have you had him on before?
Not yet.
Oh, you gotta have him. He's a great
fascinating being. But to get back to the question of the miracles, the cities, the demonstrations, and I can't remember who said it. You know, it's called miracle stories. Very similar to ayahuasca stories. It's like you get around somebody and they're going to tell you about how they went into the pyramid and they saw the thing where they opened their chest up and redid their metaphysical DNA and replaced their darkness with light and on, on, on. You're like, all right, whatever. I don't give a fuck. It's like you're having a dream. You know, like I don't want ayahuasca stories. It's like anytime I'm conveying some story of some great vision I had and underneath like some strong tea that I was drinking and I see the person's like eyes glazing over, I totally understand it. It's like, you know, why not just pull out some soap and blow bubbles in front of them? It's like non-different to me, right? But, you know, One thing that I noticed is that, like, when my dad was dying and I was applying some of the tools that came from Neem Karoli Baba, from his teachings, to comfort my father, is I really didn't really talk to my dad at all about Neem Karoli Baba. But what I did do is I was with him in the moment, and I was giving him as much as I could what he needed in that moment to gracefully transition.
Yeah.
And my father in that moment met Neem Karoli Baba without me mentioning it at all. And so there's a, one of the,
in what way? Just in the pure blissfulness way, or in the,
in from seeing his son, who he is formerly known as a miscreant, as someone who is like very selfish and self-absorbed, or a retreater, someone who like retreats from problematic situations, suddenly being there with him and doing and like loving him and expressing love and being in the moment, but not like trying to shove him towards love or make him open his eyes to just you chant this yeah. before you die, any of that. Just in being the, my dad saw it. And that thing is, to me, that is Neem Karoli Baba. It's like the visions are beautiful, and the stories I've heard about him, I do believe them, and I think they're real, and I don't understand how that works, but it's real. But to me, what's impressive about this being is that because of this man in a blanket, I was able to comfort my father who was dying.
That's so cool.
That's, to me, the guru, you know. And there's a saying, and I can't remember which guru said this, which is, I give them what they want so that they'll take what I give. Which is, the miracles and stuff are the bait in this wonderful trap. In fact, the opposite of a trap, which is we're drawn to them. What the fuck? He's telepathic?
Opposite of trap in that it's a release.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Maybe you could say it's the lure that gets us out of the trap.
Oh, that's cool.
So he puts these lures out, and it's like, oh my God, he could translocate? What the fuck? That can't be real.
And the best is when he would fake it for some people that didn't deem worthy, but it was more about making sure that Ram Dass isn't using him as a parlor trick. You know that story where he's like saying like, oh, you're from Canada? And he's like, no, I'm actually from the States. Like, oh, you're an engineer. No, I'm actually I'm a doctor. And he just intentionally got everything wrong about
getting it all wrong.
The prediction. And then he just thought it was just some old, you know, sham.
Right. And that, I, you know, all those stories, and you know, these people are my teachers and I love them. And there's stories of Neem Karoli Baba I like to listen to. But to me, what I love more than that is that when I'm in their presence, there is just this sense of compassion that is so healing. The stories are fucking cool, man. They're awesome. But man, the stories are just the flower.
Yeah.
But those roots, they go so deep. And I like it all. I like the whole tree of the thing, I guess you could say, you know, just like the fireworks are fireworks. You watch them. They're awesome. You know, they're cool. They're beautiful, but you still got to go home.
Yeah. The real thing is not the firework machine. It's the guy at the machine. That guy. Nah, it's my
is
attempt
it the
at
light,
that. No.
Or is it the bulb? You know, we'll never know the answer. But
was it on here where you had not Jason Louvre, I think Jason Silva, and it surprised me that he was going down the very materialist route where he very much thinks that, you know, it's all a trick of the brain and we need to do what we can to keep the brain going.
Yes,
and
yes.
Like he's very, which there's truth to that, but it surprised me how bought into it he was.
Well, that's his, you know, from his reality tunnel, and I don't know where he's at now, but his reality tunnel is based on, the concept.
Isn't that weird that I do that where I'm like, I'm referencing something that someone in the past said, and I'm trying to like make sure that guy in the past isn't materialist, because then that conflicts with my wanting it to be material.
We don't want to get our heads chopped off. I mean, this is a transhumanist concept of eternalizing the physical body because there's no guarantee that after we die, there's anything after that. And they want to be embodied in the material universe eternally as that form. And because that's all they based on their, the way that they're categorizing the universe is based on data from the material universe and physics, and like they're the woo-woo stuff for them. It's just like they're pretty skeptical of that. They're like, okay, sure, you take that bet, but I want to keep my body going. I'm going to keep it going. You know, it reminds me a little bit of people who figured out ways using MAO inhibitors to make smoking DMT last longer.
Oh, I think Shane might have done that.
He did, yeah, with Syrian rue.
That's the antidepressant, right?
Syrian rue is an MAO inhibitor. Okay. I don't think it's an antidepressant, but it definitely like helps the dimethyltryptamine stay in your body longer. This is the same thing with ayahuasca. You know, it's like the. It's
I feel like 5 minutes is enough.
Right.
Five minutes is a lifetime.
Right, and some people think that a lifetime's enough here in this particular wonderful hallucinatory experience we call human incarnation. But some people are like, I want to stay high forever.
Yeah.
These are the transhumanists. They want to stay here forever. They want their physical form to maintain. They want their consciousness to maintain forever. And I think that's a testament to their love of life. I don't agree with it. You know, as far as I've always, one of my favorite things about LSD is coming down. It's like, holy God, that was fucking intense. But Jesus, the next day when everything's colorful and bright,
oh yeah,
you've done the work and you're like, wow, this is amazing. That was incredible. You know, I like that.
But yeah, I'm definitely one of the people that looks forward to coming back like in the middle of the trip.
Yeah. And I think that,
because there's so much to work with afterwards. And yeah. I think maybe, yeah, you and I both were workers. We like to do and also not do, but like it would be, you don't do this for money. You do this because you love it, and for money probably, but you would probably still do this if there was no money anymore.
Oh yeah. No question.
If you didn't need it, if it was just Star Trek land, they figured out money. There's a matter synthesis machine, a holodeck.
How depressing would that be if one day I just like do a very short podcast opening where I'm like, hey guys, not making money on this anymore. This is the last episode.
And you'd probably never end this, right? Because this isn't a show like Seinfeld where, well, we did it. Now it's at the top. We got to leave. It's like you're probably going to always be doing this because this is just you communicating with the world and you having
conversations. No, I do it because of the conversation.
Yeah.
I love the conversation. I grow from it. And it,
me too.
It's the, you're, and I'm, yeah, you at, what are you, 24 eps into your podcast now?
Yeah.
So like you're experiencing, I'm sure, the reality of podcasting, which is that, there is potential for making money and there's potential for material success and there's potential for a lot of those things. But really what is happening is it's a transformative medium. So you're sort of like every single conversation, it's helping you become a better person.
Yeah, hopefully. People are drugs, like, and not even in a like, you know, neurochemistry sort of way, that way too, but also in a way that they change you. Just when you came on my show, there's a couple of things you said that just stuck with me from that day, like burned into my brain, that really helped, which you don't even probably remember having saying them. Just something like, oh yeah, you're trying to squeeze out little love turds, like, and just get as many out as you can. And it made me like just compare it to like, oh yeah, this like obsession, this fetishization of releasing whatever books or albums or things as being the most important thing, when really it's the being it. Not that releasing stuff is bad either, but just the getting caught up in it.
It's a process.
Yeah.
And it's like there's moments in the process that grab our minds. There is either the moment of success, the moment of failure,
and worst. The in between is the worst. The nothing.
Yeah, all these things grab our attention. And so all of a sudden it's like now we're doing it for this reason or that reason. And it's it just infinitely goes back to like, okay, well, now I got lost pretty good in that pursuit of that thing or that worry over that. But it all just keeps coming back to, okay, but now I'm here.
Yeah.
Here we are. Oh, there it is.
Did we talk about, this might be a repetition of it. We either talked about it in real life or on a podcast or something, but how, you know, the Earth never revisits its spot.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So
infinite
like,
movement.
Yeah, infinite movement. So if something takes place, it literally takes that spot. That now has that, like, if it's writing onto a disc, it's
never
got that spot.
Never twice, brother.
Yeah.
That's it. And it's like, and that's a very liberating thing. You know, it's a liberating thing. It's just, the idea is back to the moment. It's like, here we are. We're fucking dropping weird dyes, neurological dyes into the clear water of self. And that's an interesting thing to look at. It's like, whoa, what fucking colors am I dropping in my water? Why am I always nervous? Why am I always angry? Why am I always remembering these things? But then more importantly, who is remembering? Who is dying the water? Who is the one experiencing this? And these, you know, questions, I think, are tricks, mnemonic devices, GIFs, various ways to get our fingers a little more pried off of the electrical fence of the various things that we get attached to. And, you know,
hold on tightly, let go lightly.
Ah!
Yeah.
What a beautiful way to end the show. How could people find you?
You can go to RaminNazer.com or RainbowBrainSkull.com. Instagram is the most active one, just RaminNazer on Instagram. And
where do you go up these days?
Comedy-wise, I do a show at Alternate Universe in Echo Park. This is in Los Angeles. And I do a like 15-minute animated intro. I'd love to have you on sometime. Not to put you on the spot.
I've taken a grief hiatus from stand up. I'd love to make that.
How long have you taken? Because I've been doing that too. Like taking, and it's good hearing other people talk about being, you know, taking a break.
Don't use
from
me
it.
As a reference. I'm a lazy comic. No.
Okay, like Gerard Carmichael. Like Gerard Carmichael was asked how often he's been on stage this year, and he's like, I think I've gone up 2.5 times, and he's like, I'm just more about hanging out in music studios nowadays, and just other people, like, I don't want to out them or anything in case they don't want to be seen as an inactive stand-up, but I've been seen as this kind of person to some people that they come to me for advice, like, you're good at not putting what you do in a box and doing all the things. I'm interested in taking a break from stand-up and doing this. What do you think of this thing? And meanwhile, I was thinking I was being a failure at stand-up. But to answer your question, yeah, Alternate Universe is my show that I do. To plug in other places that I might be, let's see, Dynasty Typewriter. Dynasty Typewriter Theater, the West Side Comedy Theater in Santa Monica.
My friends, go see this genius perform and definitely check out his art on his website. Brother, thank you so much.
Thank you, man. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Thank you all so much for listening to this episode of the DTFH, which just got an award. I'm opening the envelope up right now from the American Awards Department. And wow, yet again, the DTFH was awarded Best Podcast of the Week. And that's been happening for about 3 years now. So I couldn't do this without my wonderful writers. Thank you so much, Gregor Michelson. Enormous thank you to Terry. And of course, Lady Lazak, who is not only a wonderful writer, but one of my dearest friends. I want to thank you guys so much for writing the scripts for this. And also, of course, a big thank you to Ramin Nazer for flying over here in his hot air balloon and doing this episode. All the links you need to get to him will be at DuncanTrussell.com, along with the links to Charlotte's Web, to Squarespace, and of course, there will be several missing links there, which everybody's looking for them, but when you find them, you realize that there's a reason they are missing. I hope you guys have an incredible weekend, week, year, millennia, century. And of course, if you enjoy this podcast, don't forget to pet a dog and kiss it on his or her sweet, sweet, wet nose for me. Thank you so much. Until next time, Hare Krishna.